D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
Mit Katrin Ohlendorf. Heute Does Trust Have a History? Von Ute Frevert. Vertrauen ist allgegenwärtig. Da reicht ein Blick in die Tageszeitung, um sich das vor Augen zu führen. Das Vertrauen der Anleger in die Finanzmärkte ist erschüttert. Immer mehr niederländische Patienten vertrauen Ärzten im Ausland. Blindes Vertrauen lässt App-Kunden in Betrugsfalle tappen. Und natürlich, in Italien ist die Vertrauenskrise trotz Berlusconis Rücktritt noch nicht ausgestanden. Aber was ist Vertrauen eigentlich? Ist es ein Gefühl? Ist es eine grundlegende menschliche Eigenschaft, ein modernes Phänomen, ein Mechanismus zur Reduktion sozialer Komplexität, wie Niklas Luhmann in seinem Buch über Vertrauen schrieb? Oder ist es all dies vielleicht auch gleichzeitig? Fest steht, ohne ein Mindestmaß an Vertrauen wäre der Einzelne nicht lebensfähig. Er könnte nichts mehr essen, nicht mehr schlafen, sich nicht mal mehr fortbewegen. Und auch eine Gemeinschaft wäre nicht möglich. Wie viel Vertrauen ist aber notwendig und gut? Und wie können wir das einschätzen? Wie lernen wir das? Fragen über Fragen, die ein einfaches Wort aufwirft, das wir täglich völlig selbstverständlich gebrauchen. Das Einstein Forum Potsdam ist angetreten, zumindest einige dieser Fragen zu beantworten oder zumindest zu diskutieren. Und zwar gleich mit einer ganzen Tagung. On Trust hieß die und fand am 3. und 4. November dieses Jahres im Einstein-Forum statt. Dominik Bonfiglio, ein junger Forschungsassistent am Einstein-Forum, hat die Tagung konzipiert und Wissenschaftler verschiedenster Fachbereiche dazu eingeladen. Historiker zum Beispiel, Politikwissenschaftler, Philosophen und Ökonomen befassten sich mit dem Thema Vertrauen aus ihrer jeweils ganz eigenen Perspektive. Darunter der britischstämmige Philosoph Philipp Kitscher oder der deutsche Philologe Jan-Philipp Remzma. Diese Tagung können Sie heute und in unseren kommenden Sendungen als Reihe hören. Ein Vorlesungsverzeichnis finden Sie auf unserer Website wissen.deradio.de. Heute starten wir mit der historischen Perspektive, und zwar der von Ute Frevert, ihres Zeichens Direktorin des Max-Planck-Instituts für Bildungsforschung. Und sie stellt, etwas erkältet offensichtlich, so wie ich, die Frage: Hat Vertrauen eine Geschichte? Gleich Ihre Antwort. Zuvor aber noch eine kleine Einführung in die Tagung von Dominik Bonfiglio.
As an academic subject, trust is nothing new. The thin trickle of publications on trust in the 1970s and 80s gave way to a veritable flood of monographs in the 90s, in the aughts, and now in the tens, several of which were written by speakers invited here today. And as I gleaned from my conversation with Russell Hardin in the taxi ride from Tegel this morning, the number of professional conferences, series, and research projects on trust in the past decade has been staggering. Why all the recent interest? I suppose some of it has resulted from a kind of domino effect. Once scholars write a few influential works about a subject, their colleagues or their rivals or their students will endeavor to write more nuanced, more comprehensive studies in the same area, and at some point what began as a personal niche becomes an established professional field. Such is the nature of academia. But I suspect that recent interest in trust also has to do with recent history. The dissolution of the Soviet Union and its satellite states in the late 80s and early 90s reminded us that entire systems of government and belief can collapse seemingly overnight. September 11, 2001 showed us how 19 men with nothing more than box cutters, some basic piloting skills, and a willingness to die could undermine a nation's sense of security within hours, and the world's within days. And the global financial crisis that began in 2008 and continues to wreak havoc today demonstrated that the very system that was supposed to have triumphed over communism, the very system that was supposed to have been reliable and hardy and realistic and self-correcting, was dangerously unstable and vulnerable. The strange thing about trust is that you don't really start thinking about it until you lose it. More abstractly, you could put it this way. Betrayal is an epistemic condition of perceiving trust as trust. There's another explanation for scholars' interest in trust, and it is one of the main reasons the Einstein Forum decided to devote an entire symposium to the subject, and that is that trust affects us all at every level. Although many thinkers are, with justice, skeptical of universal pronouncements, I'm prepared to go out on a limb and say that trust is a cornerstone of human life, and maybe some of higher animal life as well. Without it, we'd all live in paralyzing fear, bereft of orientation, helpless in face of complexity and contingency. Yet trust is also notoriously fragile. It's lost in one area, in the strength of a relationship, in the benevolence of a neighbor, in an ever-upward trend of the housing market, in the security of one's job, in the sincerity of a politician, in the stability of society, in the health of one's body, can be swift, and it can affect our trust in everything else. Maintaining trust requires steady affirmation across the board. Even a brutal murderer and serial liar like Tony Soprano has to cultivate trust among his family members as well as within his crew. Relations of trust among people tell us much about who they are in the society they live in, what is normal and reasonable, what is exceptional and shocking. Even among Western countries, there are striking differences. Anyone who's lived in Berlin will know the almost comical levels of mistrust in everyday life. And I can just give you one small example as a foreigner in this place. My perception is that when you're in a store and one of the clerks makes a mistake, the general tendency is to blame you for their own mistake, mainly because they don't trust that you could possibly be gracious with them and forgive them for making the mistake. So it's sort of a preventative action. And contrast this kind of mistrust with the one true civic religion of Americans at large, affable credulity. In the U.S., stock and interpersonal trust trades high, while institutional mistrust is inflationary. When the world is cold and brutish, Americans look to family or neighbors or friends or fellow parishioners for assistance. When the world is cold and brutish on the continent, Europeans traditionally turn to the state, though whether they will continue to do so in the future is excruciatingly unclear at this time. But trust is also difficult to pin down and harder still to measure. Trust can be interpersonal, institutional, psychological, epistemological, theological, ontological, or metaphysical, and questions about which form of trust is most fundamental and the connections among the various manifestations have engendered much discussion. Another challenge posed by trust is its embeddedness in a cluster of concepts from which it is hard to disentangle. These include hope, faith, reliance, confidence, expectation, optimism, security, and fidelity. In everyday use, their semantic fields frequently intersect and in some cases entirely overlap. Any attempt to set a firm definition of trust will hence limit the term's wide range of application and may seem arbitrary besides. On the other hand, if we leave trust undefined, it can wind up something of a grab bag concept, some nebulous ability without which we could exist neither in nature nor in communities, which is why most thinkers on trust try to offer definitions, even if the definitions are never entirely satisfying. To provide some orientation at the start of the symposium, I'd like to offer just a few thoughts on what seems to me to be the everyday contours and questions of trust. Some members of the audience will no doubt beg to differ with my views, but I trust, or I'd like to trust, that any disagreement I cause will be productive. The first thing I'd argue is that trust is more than reliable expectation. Consider sentences like, "I trust in our defeat," or "I trust I'll get sick." We can say them, of course, and people will know what we mean, but they seem peculiar. This is because trust, I think, typically has to do with the expectation of a good outcome, though it may not be a reliable outcome. Indeed, one could argue that the moment we feel we can rely on a good outcome, we have no reason to trust in it. Trust indicates a willingness to accept a certain level of contingency. When we trust, we don't assume a positive outcome is fact. We take it as a working hypothesis. We know full well it may be refuted at any time, but with an attitude of trust, that possibility will not unmoor us. We may feel secure in our trust, but trust is far less than the security of certainty. Trust is also more than hope, though it is not quite optimism either. Hopes can be desperate, a shot in the dark despite the odds, and optimism can be all-reaching, the tendency to see everything as trustworthy. Trust is both more grounded and more specific than either of those. Trust in a certain good outcome dies long before hope for it, and in most cases, trust follows some sort of grappling with the thing to be trusted. Is it trustworthy? And if not, what are my options? Conversely, the absence of trust is less than pessimism. When you're a pessimist, you automatically expect that something bad will happen and you prepare for it, either by staying home or setting your expectations below the threshold of disappointment. Not having trust goes deeper. Its absence does not indicate a state of mistrust. Even when we doubt, we must trust in something. And this is something that Jan Philipp Bremsma reminds us and will remind us again in his talk later today. The reality is that a complete lack of trust is much more akin to all-out madness than skepticism. Is trust the same thing as confidence? Nicholas Luhmann argued that it is not. For him, confidence arises, quote, when you don't know what else to do. Our belief that the sun will rise tomorrow, for example. Trust, by contrast, requires previous engagement and a situation of risk. When we trust, we take for granted the possibility of our disappointment. I don't know if I agree with Luhmann. I think it all depends on whether we accept his definition of confidence. But the issue does point to an important question. Namely, does trust always require a rationale? Does trust in a situation of risk always need to be justified? And if so, what are its criteria? Or is trust justified by definition, in that the very act of trusting presupposes that the truster thinks his trust justified, whatever the grounds? Can we decide to trust even when we feel we have no reason to, because we can't bear doing otherwise? Think of the suspecting spouse who reads his partner's diary or email. A single act of distrust can shake a relationship's foundations, even if there's just cause for suspicion. Can trust be justified in some cases as a duty? Another question concerns the nature of trust. One position holds it to be a belief about future behaviors or events, where we trust X when we feel it is reasonable to believe that X will do Y. A second argues that trust must also contain an emotional component. It's not a purely rational decision. The evidence for the latter is that people do not always trust everything they deem trustworthy, and vice versa. For instance, when parents trust their child to complete a task for the first time, they have no reason to trust that the child will come through, but they know that a trusting attitude will help ensure he or she does. Gestures like these can be understood as something like trust advances. Psychologists call it therapeutic trust. And they can foster a trusting atmosphere in any relationship, almost as if trust itself were somehow contagious. From a certain rationalistic perspective, trust advances like these might seem like a salto mortale. But it's a risk many are willing to take, especially when love is involved. Or consider people with trusting personalities. Compared with those who are guarded, they see many more reasons to trust in the first place. Perhaps trust, or the disposition to trust, does share something in common with optimism after all. But talk of trust can also make you wonder, do we trust in trust too much? Too much trust makes us vulnerable, after all. We're at the mercy of those who would sooner pull the wool over our eyes. It also exposes us to disappointment, even devastation. Some people are hurt once and never love again. If the U.S. stock market were to lose 80% of its value tomorrow, the erosion of trust would be massive and, given anything but instant recovery, enduring. A single dirty bomb set off in a major metropolitan area could eliminate trust in open society for decades, if not altogether. So is trust overrated? Perhaps, but too little trust can make us paranoid, unable to live in any community greater than one, not to mention forge lasting emotional ties with others. And though fragility seems to be part of trust's very essence, This needn't be seen as a deficit. Its fragility bears witness to the openness of human action and human history, for better or for worse. To my mind, we have no alternative but to accept the inherent risk that we'll be disappointed or betrayed. Part of what it means to become an adult and find orientation in this world of ours, I think, is to trust and fail, and nevertheless, trust again. Our symposium now will begin with some historical perspective on trust. Our speaker is Ute Frevern. She is the director of the Max Planck Institute for Human Development and the head of its Center for the History of Emotions. She has written many works on cultural and political history, and she was a professor of German history at Yale University, among other universities in Germany. She is also a member of the Einstein Forum's Board of Advisors. Thank you.
I will try to give you some historical ideas and reflections on trust, since I think that, of course, you can look at trust from various angles. You can look at it from a philosophical point of view. You can define it as a once and for all concept, but you can also see how trust actually enters the world of conscious discourse and communication, and that's exactly what I want to do here. We are currently attributing a lot of what goes wrong in the world to a lack of trust in the economy, in politics, in personal relations. Trust, it seems, even more than money, makes the world go round, and a lack of trust creates problems or makes it extremely difficult to solve problems. This obsession with trust, I will argue, is not a recent phenomenon. Rather, it's a central feature of modernity as it developed since the 18th century. This argument may come as a surprise. Why on earth should the modern world system be so keen on trust? Does it not provide us with all kinds of institutions and regulations that seek to facilitate cooperation, render social order possible, and reduce uncertainty? Uncertainty is a crucial issue here. In social science, trust is usually and substantially linked to the experience of uncertainty. Trust, to quote Georg Simmel, bridges the gap between knowing and not knowing. This basically turns trust into an essential component of the human condition. Everyone acts in risk and uncertainty in any place at any time. So trust seems to be something like an anthropological necessity inherent in any cooperation among people. However, there are evident cultural, social, and historical differences. Societies differ not only in the quantity and nature of risks they produce, they also differ in the degree to which they try to and succeed in reducing those risks. Consequently, they also differ in the mechanisms to install trust and in the degree to which they value and encourage trust among citizens. Social scientists have, as usual, been quite bold in making sound guesses about those differences. Simmel, to start with, expected less trust in so-called primitive or face-to-face societies in which everybody knew everybody else. In contrast, modern, highly differentiated societies whose members see each other as strangers needed much more trust. Niklas Luhmann shared this view when he talked about trust as a reduction of complexity. Since complexity is regarded as a characteristic feature of modern societies, trust is a functional necessity in those societies and largely irrelevant in earlier types. Most recently, and of course Simmel and even Luhmann go back far in time, for our society that is accelerating or has this kind of accelerated sense of time now. More recently, some scholars have taken a different perspective. They do agree that modern societies are more complex and interactive than pre-modern ones. People cooperate with more people over more issues. But as they can rely on an ever denser network of social, legal, economic institutions, they can easily live without trust. Trust then appears to be much more in demand in societies lacking such institutions. Now, what do historians say to this? As a general rule, they, me, deeply distrust the assumption that pre-modern societies could either do without trust, because they were less complex and interactive, or produce trust in abundance, since everybody knew everybody else and could thus rely on them. First of all, pre-modern societies have never been so homogeneous, face-to-face, and self-contained as sociologists would have us believe. Apart from their structural asymmetry and hierarchy, which also shaped information and communication, they were familiar with the stranger figure, someone who knocks on the door at night, asking to be let in. His visit might be for better or worse, no one knows in advance. Our fairy tales and proverbs are full of the ambiguity and anxiety which those encounters entail, and so are religious texts. Tribal, ancient, and medieval societies have developed more or less sophisticated rituals on how to deal with strangers, welcoming them or not, excluding or including them, giving and building trust or withholding it. Furthermore, uncertainty has haunted humans across space and time. Threats to one's well-being were ubiquitous, and people tried out different ways in order to avoid or to cope with them. There have been dangers posed by the environment, like food shortages, epidemics, or natural disaster, but also risks defined as self-inflicted uncertainties. Risky behavior characterized kings like the Macedonian Alexander the Great, who took his armies as far as India in the 4th century before the Common Era. It was part of Marco Polo's voyage to China in the 13th century and of the Fuggers' far-distance trade starting in the 15th century. All these endeavors needed trust in God and in people whose behavior could never be entirely predictable. But didn't I just claim that trust is basically a modern phenomenon? Do we have a contradiction here? No, not really. Modernity, I would argue, greatly increases and generalizes the demand for trust. Mobility becomes a way of life available to or forced upon more and more people. Everyone may be a stranger at a certain point in a certain situation. Uncertainties increase, and so do the means to cope with them, which then might induce new risks. Modernity, however, is not just about risk-reducing and risk-producing mechanisms. It's also about institution building. It is institutions that offer us, modern people, our fundamental sense of security, as far as there is one. We rely on educational institutions to teach our children how to do well in this ever-changing world. We rely on economic and financial institutions in order to make a living. We rely, and please be aware of my wording here, I don't talk about we trust, we rely on insurance companies to help us cope with illness or old age. And we rely, crucially, on the rule of law and on legal, administrative, and police institutions to protect our rights and to deal with those who violate. This aspect has been emphasized in Jan-Philipp Remsma's book, of course. Now, how do trust and institutions fit together? What about the argument that institutions essentially render trust unnecessary? I would not deny that institutions indeed do a good job of reducing risks and uncertainties, which again doesn't mean cutting them altogether. Any interaction, no matter how closely scrutinized, entails a certain degree of uncertainty. You can never be 100% sure that a friend will cooperate and treat you in a way that protects and even furthers your well-being, even if the code of friendship is deeply cherished in a given society's culture. You can never be sure that the person you lend money to will give it back, even if there are legal obligations to do so. This is where you need trust, again, to quote Simmel, to bridge the gap between knowing and not knowing, and to help you act under conditions of uncertainty. The fact that there are institutions regulating our behavior undoubtedly helps a lot to narrow the gap, but it cannot close it completely. Think, for example, famous example, of cab drivers. They need a fair amount of trust when taking passengers. How do they know that they will get paid? How can they make sure that they won't get hit on the head instead and even get killed? They can't. And this is why they have to trust. But how does trust develop? On what grounds is it given or withheld? For cab drivers, this is not a theoretical question. It might become a matter of life and death. So, what do they actually do? How do they decide who to trust and who not to trust? How do they establish their customers' trustworthiness? A recent study about taxi drivers in New York and Belfast revealed interesting differences. While New Yorkers responded positively to ethnic sameness, those from Belfast based their trust on religious grounds. This indicates that trustworthiness is a highly contingent category, contingent on matters of class, age, gender, sexual orientation, religion, ethnicity, nationality, you name it. I once overheard an English woman, lady actually, telling the story of how she had been cheated by a seemingly trustworthy man. He had impressed her with his polite manners, his Oxford accent, and the way he dressed. So she gave him the money that he had requested and promised to send back, and she obviously never got it back. Germans would probably value other signs of trustworthiness. The accent would not play a role. So there is a lot to be said about markers of trustworthiness depending on highly variable social and cultural codes and perceptions. As a general rule, contiguity and resemblance seem to allow for higher degrees of trust, which, in a way, contradicts Simmel's argument that close-knit communities or primitive societies do not need trust because their members know each other so well. We can actually turn the argument around. Contiguity and resemblance produce trust rather than rendering it superfluous. But they also render those who are alien extremely susceptible to our distrust. Here is where institutions have a role to play. Instead of reducing the need for trust, institutions enable social trust and, through cooperation, even promote it. Without institutions, it's much harder to convey trust. How can you trust strangers when there is no one to protect you and your interests? On the other hand, the fact that my rights and interests are protected by law, by the police, the state, can make it much easier for me to trust someone I do not know. This, then, would turn trust into an emotional style and practice that can be realized most fully under conditions of modernity. Modernity allows me to choose between trust and distrust and to mix the two. It prevents me from bestowing blind trust and making a fool of myself by bestowing blind trust. But it also liberates me from having to be a thoroughly distrustful person and as such leading a miserable, unhappy life. At this point, I'm suggesting something which escapes those who think in purely functionalist terms. There is an emotional value to trust, and Dominic already alluded to that, that cannot be adequately judged by any theory which perceives men and women as players who only cooperate in order to maximize their economic and material gains. Instead, I see trust as part of an emotional lexicon. Susan would probably say moral lexicon, but you can agree on that. Exactly. And this lexicon is closely tied to the moral foundations of modern democracy. This lexicon introduces trust on two levels. First, as a general feature of both horizontal and vertical social relations. And second, as a substantial investment into people's well-being. Modernity does not just allow us to trust, it also wants us to trust. We modern people love to trust, and we actually taught, it's not coming through our genes, it's a cultural learning process, because trusting makes our lives easier and nicer. We feel happier when we can trust, and we disapprove of suspicious and distrustful people. We don't want to count them among our friends. Trust, so to speak, is a feel-good word in a way, and we therefore use and invoke it in abundance. At the same time, trust cannot be reduced to its instrumental value. Trust is not equivalent to, say, confidence, reliance, or accountability. Trusting a person is more than expecting him or her to act in an orderly, stable, and predictable manner. Trusting a person means expecting him or her to act in my very best interest. By implication, those interests have to be acknowledged, respected, and appreciated. The trusted person is thus called upon to treat me with benevolence and sympathy. He has, to quote Russell Hardin here, although in a sense that he would probably not agree with, he has to take my interests, my well-being, to heart. These emotional overtones and ingredients of trust have been made quite explicit at the beginning of the modern period. When defining trust, authors of the late 18th and early 19th centuries regularly stressed the element of benevolence and sympathy. Trusting someone meant hoping for the other to increase my own well-being and security. But who could be trusted? Let's zoom in for 2 minutes on an article on trust published in 1746 in one of the first German language encyclopedias. Encyclopedias, as a genre, date back to the 18th century. They collected, summed up, and presented current knowledge, fresh knowledge, for well-educated readers who craved for information and orientation in a rapidly changing world. Now, what does the article have to say to its avid readers? Interestingly, 90% of the text deals with trust in God, which is taken to be the most fundamental type of trust. At first glance, this indicates the strong grip that religion still had on people's minds and behavior around the mid-18th century, with the Protestant tradition resonating, of course, as Luther has warned against trusting people because only God deserved trust. Upon closer examination, though, we might wonder to what degree this warning was rooted not so much in theological dogma, but in social experience. It might well reflect pre-modern conditions of basic uncertainty and contingency. First, most of the dangers threatening individuals seemed to be beyond human control: famine, disease, catastrophic weather, ubiquitous death. Only God could help in those cases, and thus it was He who had to be trusted. Second, there was a high amount of instability in political and economic relations. Legal safeguards were underdeveloped and did not offer much support. Trusting people was therefore in itself a high-risk operation. Indeed, our author only mentioned and approved of social trust once. He reserved it for the relationship between a doctor and his patient. Here, trust seemed to be both necessary and possible. In other respects, the author recommended caution, and he deliberately and very outspokenly distanced himself from others who apparently took a different stance. He maliciously called them Erneuerte, the modernized, i.e. followers of progress and the Enlightenment. He obviously did not share their positive views on mankind. For him, men were fragile, and women, of course, even more so. Men were fragile and unstable, unsuitable to be trusted. Recommending more trust among people, as the modernizers and modernists and modernized obviously did, equaled weakness, not strength. This article from 1746 provides a great starting point, I think, for our investigation into the history of trust and distrust. It draws our attention to a controversy that in many ways has defined and shaped the emergence of modernity. Should the new modern society be based on trust or distrust? How much trust is necessary in order to build a civil society? Is distrust good or bad? What kind of institutional setup do we need in order to enable citizens to form relationships based on trust? Again, encyclopedias offer some insight into this debate and into its consequences. To cut a long story short, the modernists were on the winning side. Throughout the 19th century, the importance of social trust increased so that it practically eclipsed the notion of trust in God, at least in the articles, maybe not in real life. Trust among export merchants, between soldiers and their officers, between the rich and the poor, between servants and masters, Among friends and family is mentioned time and again. Furthermore, composite words proliferate, testifying to the increasing appeal of trust. Pedagogical literature embraces the concept as fundamental in the teacher-student relationship. Parents are advised to raise their children in a manner that will encourage them to trust. Trust even enters industrial relations. Since the late 19th century, more and more companies have introduced workers' councils consisting of elected, entrusted members, Vertrauensmänner. Their role was to negotiate with the company owner or manager, thus learning to surmount mutual distrust, a quote from 19th century. While distrust was seen as disruptive and obstructive, trust was held to foster communication and cooperation, qualities that were deemed crucial for a modern society with a high and ever-rising degree of labor division. Last but not least, trust entered the political arena. Citizens used trust to claim more political rights. Governments and monarchs demanded to be trusted and pretended to be trustworthy. It is this political dimension of trust that I want to focus on during the remaining time for my talk.
Sie hören die Historikerin und Direktorin des Max-Planck-Instituts für Bildungsforschung, Ute Frevert, mit ihrem Vortrag Does Trust Have a History? Dieser Vortrag war am 3. November dieses Jahres Auftakt zur Tagung on Trust des Einstein-Forums Potsdam. Gleich geht es damit weiter.
Die Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit, die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
Trust is a relatively new word in the emotional lexicon of politics. Political scientists will easily trace it back to John Locke, the British liberal philosopher writing in the late 17th century. Locke coined the phrase government by trust. In this view, trust defined the relations between the people and the parliament that held supreme power, i.e. the power to pass laws. The Parliament acted as the trustee of the British people, with which it shared not only interests, but also, as Edmund Burke put it a century later, feelings and desires. Such trusting relations were essentially absent on the European continent, where monarchs held absolute power, and Parliament, in the British sense, was unknown. Instead of trust, people here spoke of loyalty and fidelity. The absolute princes commanded their subjects loyalty and obedience, not their trust. So what is the difference between trust and fidelity/loyalty? The main difference, as I see it, concerns issues of fluidity and stability. Fidelity/loyalty, in the medieval sense, characterized relationships that were bound to last. Once sworn, Fidelity, loyalty could not be broken. Breaking it was synonymous with treason, which was considered a major crime. And you know what happened then. In contrast, trust is reversible and may be lost. Although it remained part of the traditional semantics of allegiance, love, and reverence, it gradually cast off its passive connotations and acquired a more active quality. Talking trust increasingly meant negotiating power relations. Those who offered trust made demands. They stated conditions under which trust was granted and threatened to withhold it in case those conditions were not met. Trust thus became a part of the new emotional lexicon introduced in continental Europe by the upheaval of the French Revolution. Even in those countries which did not follow the French model, it made an impact. Monarchs who did not want to share the fate of Louis XVI were eager to, quote, strengthen the bonds of trust between us and our people. Self-confident citizens, in turn, urged the government to trust the people instead of demanding people's trust. In 1848, they campaigned for a trusting state, a Vertrauensstaat, meaning that the monarchy should share power rather than monopolize it. Sharing power also entailed making power transparent. Secrecy who is believed to harm and impede trust, while openness enabled trust to flourish. During those negotiations over power, trust was presented as a scarce resource, as something which had to be built and consolidated by a chain of favorable decisions and careful policy making. What lay below this message was an abundance of distrust. Distrust, too, was a new lemma in the emotional lexicon of 19th century politics. It followed on from trust in a way. Talking about trust as a political demand opened up the possibility to talk about the lack thereof, or, stronger still, the state of distrust. Distrust was defined as the weapon of the powerless or the less powerful. Certainly a newly discovered weapon, since it could only be used in a political system which valued trust. Parliamentary democracy, as it stands, emerged as a system of politics depending heavily on the delicate balance between trust and distrust. It started with a constitution as an embodiment of trust, an act of power sharing that was either forced upon or eked out of the previous monopolist. There were at least two echelons of trust, one between government and parliament, the other between parliament and citizens. Both were accompanied by inbuilt mechanisms of distrust. Citizens chose their representatives only for a limited amount of time and could obviously withdraw their trust in the following elections. The parliament also relied on a mixture of trust and distrust. It controlled and supervised the actions of the government and could withdraw its support and bring down the government by an explicit vote of distrust. In the long run, power sharing had dramatic consequences. It depersonalized power. In other words, it deprived it of its personal touch and embodiment. Republics in which both the heads of government and the heads of state offices were short-lived experienced a sense of volatility and uncertainty to which many citizens found it hard to adjust, especially in a transitional period. A legal government with a complex and efficient bureaucracy could be accountable to its citizens, thus proving itself trustworthy. But it did not infuse enthusiasm, as Max Weber knew so well. While trust and distrust had produced a powerful rhetoric during the transformative period of bourgeois revolutions and constitutional reform, they lost their appeal soon after parliamentary governments were firmly established. Modern politics, then, heavily rely on institutionalized mechanisms of trust and distrust. At the same time, though, these mechanisms tend to devour and spit out the personal, intensely emotional substance of trust. Although many efforts were made during the late 19th and 20th centuries to extend trust to institutions, this somehow did not work. People still find it hard to trust governments, parties, courts, insurance companies. They rather trust or distrust the head of government, local or national party leaders, judges, or CEOs sometimes. As for politics in parliamentary democracies, this poses a problem. First, those regimes work within clear time constraints. Governments can change every 4 or 5 years. This makes trust, which generally requires and prefers a longer chain of communication and interaction, this makes trust difficult to build. Second, parliamentary democracies tend to give more importance to political issues and programs than to political personnel. Heads of government, party leaders, whips of parliament change constantly and make it again hard for citizens to connect on a personal level. If trust primarily defines, as I would argue, relationships among people, it is very difficult to install in modern democracies. It seems to be much easier, in contrast, to install in autocratic systems or in monarchies, constitutional monarchies, where the head of government is there to stay for a long time. As we can see throughout the 19th century, there is a strong direct communication between citizens and monarchs. The more bourgeois or middle class the royal family presented itself, the more it incited popular imagination and invited personal approaches. More and more people congratulated the king or queen on his or her birthday, or sent poems, commemorating royal marriages or births. The death of a monarch sent shockwaves through the population, even when it had been expected due to old age or poor health. People were interested in personal stories, and mass media like newspapers provided them eagerly. This far exceeded what we observe as star power in our contemporary world. It was more ubiquitous, more general, and more focused at the same time. The monarch personified material and symbolic power rooted in tradition and the present political system, but he also personified or pledged to personify the nation, the fatherland, the community of citizens. Interestingly, this pre-early modern image of political power survived well into the modern period. It even survived the radical rupture that occurred in France or Germany when the monarchy was forcefully abolished and a republic was established. Reading letters that citizens addressed to the first German president, who also happened to be a socialist after 1919, conveys a surprising sense of continuity. Continuity was even more evident when his conservative successor, a former World War I general, took office in 1925. The outpouring of trust was breathtaking, and it got even stronger after Hitler, as a truly charismatic political leader, became chancellor in 1933 and president a year later. All these letters that citizens wrote were unsolicited and non-instrumental. Very few people wrote to request a favor, although many asked for a signed photograph and got it. Most authors just took pleasure in forming a personal bond and assuring the Führer or the president of their boundless love, loyalty, and, for this matter, trust. What has been lost in this communication is the conditional character of trust that was so dominant in the transformative period of constitutional politics. The new rhetoric of trust evoked, for example, by the Nazi regime, sounded rather medieval and was more akin to loyalty and fidelity. It was closely linked to obedience, following the Führer's commands with the familiar slogan that apparently found ready acceptance. At least, this is what the letters convey, speaking a more or less identical language of personal dedication mixed with highest expectations. The charismatic Führer had made many promises, and people trusted him to keep them. National Socialism, we know, was strong on propaganda. Evoking trust was among the major concerns of the regime. Trust talk abounded in political speeches as well as in the renaming of institutions. What was called Factory Council, Betriebsrat, during the Weimar Republic now figured as Council of Trust, Vertrauensrat. Trust and fidelity became the core concept of industrial relations, connecting leaders and followers in an allegedly harmonious symbiosis. Conflict and struggle were outlawed and externalized. The emphasis on trust within the national community contrasted sharply with the amount of distrust waged against those who did not belong: foreigners, German Jews, communists, and socialist internationalists. After 1945, the emotional lexicon of German politics changed considerably. Those terms that have been overused since the 1920s, and particularly during National Socialism, mostly disappeared: honor, fidelity, devotion. Interestingly enough, though, trust, that had been mixed up with fidelity before, re-entered the field. The West German Basic Law introduced trust and distrust as categories of parliamentary control over the government, which is the only time that it made explicit reference to emotions tied to procedures. When it came to the issue of people's trust, however, the lawmakers remained skeptical. They all agreed that the people should not have a direct say on politics. While the Weimar Constitution had included some plebiscitary elements, the Basic Law did not. Furthermore, it did not reinstall a strong president that, as Weimar had it, was to be elected directly by the people and could thus play out his charismatic qualities. Especially among social democrats, there was a deep distrust that people would again cherish authority and put their trust in a charismatic figure. Democracy, as Carlo Schmitt phrased it in 1948, is about citizens' self-confidence, not about their trust in others. Now, let me sum up and conclude in 3 points. First, I would like to answer my overall question that is mentioned in the title of my intervention here. Does trust have a history? I would like to answer this in the positive. I have tried to convince you that trust has gained an importance during modernity, kind of 18th century onwards, especially when referring to relationships between people, so as social trust, at the expense of trust in God, of course. Modern societies highly value or came to value trusting relationships as fostering corporations, a cooperation between their members and citizens. And they have developed and provided all kinds of institutions and associations that help to build or enable trust, that even help people to learn trust. And I did not mention here one of my kind of favorite topics, the mushrooming of associations during the 19th century as a kind of cradle of civil society, which we still can in some way or other discover in our own society. So these associations can be rightly called institutions where trust among people that don't know each other because they haven't been friends, they haven't been colleagues, they haven't been family members, learn how to trust each other. That was my first remark, conclusion. As to my second point, as a historian, I'm not satisfied with attempts to reduce trust to a reliance on institutions, on their well-functioning according to rules and procedures. Trust is not about Erwartungsstabilität. I don't deny that this is a crucial element of modernity, but it is not the whole story. Trust is different from confidence or reliance. It includes and stresses an emotional element that draws on attitudes of, as I said, benevolence and sympathy. This emotional element introduces or makes it important that actually people, persons, talk and interact with one another in all realms, even in politics. A third point, as much as modern politics show a strong trend towards a more institutional, impersonal, and bureaucratic approach, citizens use trust to reintroduce emotional bonds. The way this is done depends on the power structure of the political system, on cultural traditions, and on the availability of a public space. My thesis is that under conditions of parliamentary democracy, trust supersedes fidelity. Totalitarian systems seek, and I only mentioned the National Socialist regime, but we could also talk about Stalinism here, maybe even about post-Stalinist regimes. Totalitarian systems seek to reinstall fidelity as a vertical relationship and deprive trust, which they keep up as a semantic label, of its short-term, limited, and conditional character. And as a kind of final word, I think it's interesting to see to what degree post-totalitarian systems, kind of post-communist, post-fascist regimes that we can watch all over Europe, either after 1945 or after 1989, attempt to introduce charismatic elements that invite personal trust. And these attempts to introduce, to mingle, so to say, charismatic elements with democratic procedures is something that, for my own country, I would observe mainly kind of since the 1980s, starting with Helmut Kohl, continuing actually with Chancellor Schröder, not so much now with Frau Merkel, who rather talks of Zuversicht and confidence instead of trust. On the other hand, we might keep in mind Carlo Schmitt's warning that democracy is not about trust in others, especially not trust in charismatic political figures, but it's about citizens' self-confidence, not just the confidence in themselves, but also as a feature of mutual trust among citizens, what Klaus Offer has called trust among fellow citizens. And I found it quite revealing the other day that Helmut Schmidt, who is probably the most cherished politician now in this country, the older he gets more loved by everybody, warned or said something about trust the other day, which kind of recalls the early Carlo Schmidt sentence. He said that he also kind of discovered and noted how much politicians make a deliberate attempt nowadays to present themselves as trustworthy. And this is exactly should be a sign of warning sent out to the citizens that they should be very distrustful. Thank you very much.
Im D-Radio-Wissen-Hörsaal hörten Sie die Historikerin und Direktorin des Max-Planck-Instituts für Bildungsforschung, Ute Frevert, mit ihrem Vortrag »Does Trust Have a History?« Dieser Beitrag war der erste der Tagung »On Trust«, also »Über Vertrauen«, des Potsdamer Einstein-Forums. Die Aufzeichnung stammt vom 3. November 2011.
D-Radio-Wissen. D-Radio-Wissen. Hörsaal.